Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 150, being recorded on the 26th of October, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. And guys, a couple of interesting milestones were hit this week. All good stuff. Of course, this is episode number 150, as I just said, which is quite a milestone for us. We've been doing this now almost 3 years, so... I'm glad we're all here, you know, still doing it.
When you sent that out, it was really, I want to say time flies when you're having fun, but I can't believe it's been 3 years.
Yeah, I agree with you.
There's times it's like, oh, we only did like a year or two, right? And then you look and you're like, wow, episode 150 something. Jeez.
Yep.
So.
And the second milestone we hit, which is also very exciting for us, is, we track our listeners, using FeedBurner. I guess it tracks a number of people that are heading our RSS feed for the podcast. And we crossed 1,000 again this week, so another big milestone for us. So it looks like we're definitely going in the right direction there in terms of, I guess people finding value with the podcast and they're listening to it regularly. We've had some of our listeners actually join the podcast as we had a couple of weeks ago. So all sorts of interesting things going on. Glad to see our listeners getting more involved. We want them to reach out to us if there's topics of interest that they have that they want to cover that we haven't already covered, or if they are passionate about something and would like to share it with others, they could reach out to us via our Twitter handle, and we'll see if we can work something out there.
Yeah, no, we're thrilled to have the audience, and guys, I have to share a funny story with our audience and with you guys. So
sure, go ahead.
When I went away for the month of July, I took like the whole month off, right? So I came back, my coworkers had decorated my cube and all that, and I took a picture and sent my wife, and hanging at the edge of my desk, I have the little 8.5 by 11 ad that we have for our podcast that I've posted around the building, and we've got it I think on the website as well.
Right.
And my wife thought that was what my coworkers were making fun of me, and I said, no, this is a real thing. We have 1,000 listeners. It's real. And she just didn't believe me. So I'm glad we have thrilled that everybody likes what we're doing. I'm trying to figure out what number it has to be before my wife doesn't make fun of me for having
you have to
kind of about you guys, but
when you get called on CNN one day to offer your comments, right, that's probably when.
Nah, it'll be when Evan comes home and his wife goes, hey, so what's this AZ podcast, this Azure podcast I'm hearing about? Like, my friends were talking about it.
That's right.
That would be awesome. That would absolutely be awesome. So that's the challenge to our audience. Like, everybody tell 10 of your friends and get signed up, and then maybe we can get my wife to hear about it, right? Then she believes it. So.
It's like usual 6 degrees of separation. I'm sure it'll end soon. Okay. Kind of a light week, at least in terms of updates, right, guys? Not too much here. I think, Kale, you put a couple of things in there. Anything you want to start with?
Of course, we have to start with blockchain. I'm sorry, but no, Money 2020 is going on this week, actually, in Vegas, which is a big financial conference.
Money 2020? Course, is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's the name of the conference. A couple of our guys are there. I know Marley, the people probably recognize Marley Gray.
Yeah.
He's out there, and a few others. But the big announcement there was that we're working with Chain.com. Who, if you know much about them, you can check them out on their website. They work with NASDAQ and some of the bigger players in the space from the financial side in blockchain. So they have an open source offering called Chain Core, which we've enabled on Azure.
Cool. Chain Core.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what is, I mean, what is, you know, you're a blockchain expert, right? So I'm certainly not going to claim to, I'm still trying to absorb some of this, but, you know, like, I'm still trying to get my head around when we release something like the you know, the new variant, like, how do I know if that's for me versus the other blockchain?
Yeah, it's a good question,
features?
Right? Because there's like this stuff is coming really fast. I mean, there's a lot of new stuff happening every day. I mean, you could say like originally, and up to this point, it's kind of been a lot of infrastructure. So it's these actual chains themselves. When we talk about blockchains, the actual infrastructure to run a blockchain. I think it's starting to change a bit because, you know, as something just like anything in like Azure or servers or any of that kind of stuff, once the foundation is in place, then you have to make it something that can be real, like production. And, you know, that takes a million other things around it, like management tools and DevOps and all these other little things that make these apps work. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that bubble up.
Moving up the stack then, right, in the application stack, right? Starting low is the infrastructure, and now you're, you know, layering the services and features on top of that to make it more and more usable then.
Yeah, and I think some of these are specialized, you know, for this one especially, it's around financial transactions, so you wouldn't be using this one per se to, say, do medical records or something like that. That's a different kind of thing. There's some that are general that can basically accommodate kind of any kind of workload, and then there's some that are very specialized to certain workloads. And this is one of those variants. So when you're looking at the financial institution, and you can look at their site, but they all have their unique twist about what makes their, what's their value prop, you know, what's different about them. Are they faster? Do they handle particular type of transactions faster? These types of things.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
All right. And then I see there's another update for support for files in the storage library for C++. I'm glad that we actually have a storage library for C++. So, I you know, I come think of, this is the first time I'm hearing about this. Did we have this a long time ago, this particular library, or is it just a new thing and they've added support for files
I think
now?
That, I mean, we've had some C++ variants. I'm not sure, you know, if this is an offshoot of one of those or it's a, you know, an update of that. But we've absolutely had some SDKs for C++ in the past, almost positive.
Yeah, I think what's happening is they're getting a bit more parity, like at least from a features perspective, because in the past it was like, you know, and I think it's still to that some extent where we have a REST interface and then comes what's next, the .NET stuff, the Node stuff, and they come along. But I think now it's becoming pretty quick where a feature gets released or new things, new capabilities, and we see it pretty quickly bubble into each one of these. Which is a good thing.
Sorry, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, go ahead, Sajid.
No, I'm trying to think of the, like, who would actually use a C++ library, and it sounds like it would be, I mean, just carrying on from our discussion from last week, it sounds like, you know, if you have an IoT device, there's a good chance that the code in there is written in C++, right? I mean, most modern applications, people don't really write them in C++ unless there's a need for it, maybe a video game or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely a, I don't want to say it's a niche because there's, you know, probably millions and millions and millions of lines, you know, written every year, but it is certainly, you know, there's a class of applications and industries that is, you know, what they use. But I think this is, you know, again, they have a need for these, you know, resilient storage and you know, permanent storage. All those needs still exist, right? It's just not the first pass,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean,
I think
not
too,
as many people are going to use that.
I think, too, like, if somebody has an app, like, you think about this one, this is accessing, like, blob storage, right? It's a storage client library, and it works with files as well, but you think about it, like, somebody has some, like, I won't say legacy app, but maybe they do have a real-time application, like maybe even a trading application back to finance.
Yeah.
A lot of those are written in C++, and maybe they want to archive stuff to storage and things like that. And if we didn't have this, you know, then they're putting shims and all kinds of other things in place in order to make this work, or trying to write their own, you know, library on top of our REST API. So
I come to think of it, the blockchain stuff is probably written in C++, right? I mean, that's pretty low level.
Actually, a lot of it, some of them are written in Haskell, so they have all kind of weird exotic languages, but
okay.
It needs to be an offshoot of Pascal.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so that's the update for the storage client library for C++. What else, Evan? Anything there that you like?
I think we're continuing to, kind of improve on our government cloud stuff,
Yep.
right? Again, we've got, more regions. We've got, another couple of certifications, I guess. I don't think that's quite the right term. There's just something else that we used with the, and I forget his name, the guy we had on talked about that, but
Iron
this
Bark.
is just,
Yeah.
yeah, Aaron came on to talk about some of the government cloud stuff, but this is, we're really pushing for this stuff, and we really want to be the source for, government workloads, right? They have all the same needs that, we're talking about legacy apps and new apps. I mean, they have all the needs as same as all these big companies, because they're a huge company in essence,
Right.
right?
Right.
And so yeah, it's absolutely trying to provide the features and functionality and compliance to meet those workloads. And there's another, we'll put it in the blog, but there's another set of things that are compliances that we're working on achieving in the near future.
Cool. And Kale, what else? There you go. Anything else you want to pick up?
No, I noticed one other one around CDN, which is
Yeah.
I don't know. I wouldn't call it a niche. I mean, it's one of those things. It feels to me like it's in the background, but most people use it, but they don't talk about it a whole lot. Not that it's a bad thing. It's just kind of almost like electricity. Like you just assume if you have a high scale site, you're using some sort of CDN service to get your content out there. But there's some new features for the Akamai, which is the premium stuff up there in the our CDN offering. That allows you to do some new filtering mechanisms and things like that. So,
Yeah,
just more features being added.
I it's just coincidental. I happened to be looking into CDN this week. Someone from the office had asked about some features of it, and I decided to dig into it. And we have to do a show on that, by the way. This is one of those services that we just never got around to talking about. So we'll definitely put up a schedule a show for CDN. But when I read this update, CDNs allow you to make content available all over the world. So that it's very close to the people that are accessing it, right? That's sort of the main reason why you do use CDNs. But in some cases, you actually want to restrict certain content in some country. Maybe, in some particular country, because of some political issue, you don't want to show some of the content. You only want to restrict it, but
Right.
you want to show it everywhere else, right? And that's the challenge. So that's what this update lets you do, is it lets you apply these geo-filtering options to some of the content that you're putting out there. And that used to be available only in the premium SKUs, but both the but now it's available even on the standard SKU for Akamai. I think it's also available for the standard SKU for Verizon as well. That was there before. So I think we definitely have to get around to talking about the Azure CDN. I think it's a very good service that a lot of people, as you said, just you just use it and it kind of works, but people shouldn't know that it's available within Azure, because a lot of companies like Akamai and Verizon are the ones that come to mind, and people don't think that to look in Azure, because Azure kind of combines all that and makes it available to you in a nice kind of unified way with your other services. So we'll have to schedule that sometime.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about the history there, right? Because remember, we used to have our own, then we said, this isn't such a good idea. Let's leverage,
Yeah.
these other really good third-party services. So, yeah, no, I like the idea. We should definitely put it on our list.
And then there was the, again, continuing from last week with the IoT theme. There's all these IoT devices. We talked about briefly last week. The Raspberry Pi 3 is what I have. I think Gail said he has two. And there's so many devices. And so if you're kind of want to start building your own IoT-based system for your specific business use case, it can be a little confusing to pick the right device, because we just talked about two of them. There's probably hundreds of them that are available from different vendors around the world, and each one has a kind of a niche. And so there's this new service now from Azure that it's kind of like a little extension to the website that lets you put in some criteria, and it kind of gives you a little bit of an advice as to which device or devices might be best suited for your particular use case. So I think that's something nice, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I think the last thing from a news perspective we were talking before the show started here is, especially today, we just made this announcement about this new device, the Surface Studio.
Yeah. So it looks like you were up on it. What was your take on the device?
It looks pretty cool. I really admire Panos. He's such a showman, and he's really passionate about this product. And there's a special hinge. If you've seen the announcement, if you haven't, you should go watch it. I'm sure it's on YouTube and over the internet. But there's like these two hinges that basically hold this up. It's a 28-inch screen, I believe. Very thin, but there is some weight there, right? So the whole idea is to be able to move this thing. So like you can have it standing up, like a normal, like if you're sitting at your desk. But a lot of times today, especially in like an art or creative type environment, people are standing up, and even in IT and stuff, a lot of people are standing up at their desks, and you can kind of lay it down then, almost like a drafting table. Like you can have that angle on it. And he was showing like they put so much effort into these hinges to both make them disappear when you're looking at the thing, so you barely see them. But whenever you go to move the device, it's almost like zero gravity, he called it. And he gets into very technical detail about the 80 pieces that make up this hinge and how it's like this crazy complex thing that makes it work like its own air. And it does look impressive. It's pretty cool.
So this would be one of the advantages I have over you guys, because I'm actually in an office on a regular basis. We're going to have some of those here later this week to actually go check out. So I'm looking forward to playing with it.
Wow, lucky.
And the other thing was this little, and I'm gonna mess up the
Dial,
name,
I think we called it,
yeah, the
right?
dial, the dial. I want one of these things, like for even my Surface, because it's like this little round dial that like sits there. It's wireless, and if you have like a regular Surface, you can just use it like as an extension. It's like another input device essentially. So volume, screen brightness, all kinds of stuff. It integrates with apps. If you have one of those big devices, I don't know if it works with the small ones, but he like walked up to the screen and laid it on the screen, and as like an artist is drawing, a color wheel could pop up, and you can like start turning it with your left hand while you're drawing with the right. It's mind blowing. I mean,
The
that's
thing
awesome.
that one of the articles I was reading talking about that, kind of reminded me. I mean, that kind of dual hand interface is actually was really common back in my days when I used to do computer-aided drafting, right? Where you're doing 3D modeling because you're doing, you really need multiple hands to manage that stuff, right? And to get the full functionality and be able to do that design work. And this is right back to that. It's got the haptic response, I mean, everything, right? So, yeah, no, it looks really cool.
Okay. Well, so that's a good roundup of all the updates. Let's get to a topic that we want to talk about today. Yeah, I suppose it's not a specific Azure service that we want to talk about, but kind of something that happened last week. We talked about the IoT last week, IoT Hub, which was quite timely because I think we recorded it a couple of days before this event happened, the denial of distributed denial of service attack that happened. And again, that was it seems like now after people have analyzed it, it looks like this was something caused by a whole bunch of IoT devices, okay, which was kind of depressing on one end. That was like, oh my God, I can't believe that they're starting to use these devices as weapons. But it was just kind of timely that we just talked about the IoT Hub, and so I thought we thought we'd just spend a little bit of time about this particular attack. And from an Azure perspective, and as from our clients, I'm sure they are kind of concerned about this, and kind of just talk about why how it came about, and whether we should be really worried about this in terms of our own Azure services that you might have out there, because I guess the cloud is kind of out there, right? It's you can run, but you can't hide. That's the problem with the cloud. I thought we'd just kind of table that topic and see where it takes us. How about that?
Yeah, no, it was really. I'm still not totally sure I understand how the IoT devices were, I guess, infected is probably the right word. But I mean, maybe before we get into that, let's talk about how the what that what actually happened. To it as far as how the distributed denial of service ended up impacting everybody, because it wasn't taking down a site per se, right? It was actually taking down the DNS infrastructure, one of the big DNS infrastructures, which allows you to figure out where your site is physically,
Right.
right? I don't again, for the audience, right? Your computers don't really talk to Microsoft.com or, Azure.com or whatever. They talk to, 24.32. whatever the IP address is, and DNS is how you do that mapping, right? And but if you can't look it up, you don't know where to go, right? So like not having your GPS in your car. So what I don't know is how did they get all these devices to send these requests to DIN? Or is it Dyn? DIN? I'm not quite sure how you say that company name.
I was saying a dime, but I just guessed. I don't know.
Okay.
It was. I mean, that's. I guess the simplicity of the whole thing was you gotta hand it to the guys who came up with this idea, or the group or whatever it may be. But yeah, they went after the one thing that everybody relies on, right? Yes, in a typical denial of service attack, you can target one particular company or website, right? Which is the typical denial of service attack. They kind of get out, they kind of infect some virus into a whole bunch of computers worldwide, and they set a timer and they say, okay, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever, everybody start hitting this website, okay? And that's your typical denial of service attack, and then for that, that website will get overloaded because of all the requests that came in at the same time, and before they could kind of scramble and figure out what's going on, the website's down. But in this particular case, and that would bring one particular website down. These guys came up with a very good idea, which is to go after the, as you said, the top level DNS provider, Dyn, and do the same thing to them, flood them, so that they weren't in a position to respond to DNS requests. And as Evan was nicely explaining just now, without the DNS, everybody, almost any website, well, I wouldn't say any, but a whole region or a couple of regions within the country that were relying on those Dyn DNS servers. Started misbehaving and it wouldn't work. So you would try to go to Snapchat or Twitter, and it's not like Twitter was down. As a matter of fact, Twitter was up and probably not getting any traffic. They were like, I wonder why no one's connecting to Twitter today. It turned out they couldn't find Twitter because the DNS server was down.
I mean, because and I don't know where. I mean, part of this is right. You mentioned they were a top level DNS provider, right? And what that really for the audience means is, these DNS entries are shared, right? So some of this is distributed around. So if when say like a second level DNS provider, they're getting their information from Dyn, and then they're keeping it for I don't know, 30 minutes, right, or 5 minutes, whatever that their timeout is for that DNS record, and then when that expires, they have to go back and get it, right? So that way, somebody hitting the second level doesn't always have to go to the first level. But if once the first level is inaccessible, that starts cascading through. So this really went broad. I mean, I think it hit almost the entire East Coast, right?
Yeah, it started off in the East Coast and then slowly made its way west and in other places,
Oh, so it did end up going to, further than geographically
Yeah,
as well.
I think to your point, Evan, that's what ha was happening, right? It was like it hit the East Coast first because that's where all of us are pointing to, and then people who ultimately had to come back to that eventually over time, you could see it just like spreading, because the timeouts were starting to expire and they were starting coming back and to go, oh, yeah, can't answer that query, sorry.
Yeah, and so it's kind of an interesting thing how these guys took advantage of this kind of vulnerability in these IoT devices, right? They've got these webcams as one of the things that they targeted. So you guys have any of you have a webcam at home?
No, I mean, I have in the past, but I don't have one running now.
I have
Yeah.
one. I don't know, Kale. You have one,
No,
or do you?
only the ones in my laptop, so I don't have any externals.
I have one of those Wi-Fi webcams, and I kind of, had it from a while. I used to look at it just to keep monitor their, like, the kids' room, and then recently we got a dog, so I would monitor the dog as well as a puppy, and be able to remotely look at, make sure that the puppy is okay, Now, so these devices, they connect to Wi-Fi in your house, and they have a little web server built into them. Okay, because you need to, they're what I call pull devices, right? You have to connect into them to pull out the video feed. So if you want to get a video feed, you have to connect to it somehow, either from inside the house or through the internet, and log into this device, and then be able to go to the right screen and get the video feed, right? That's kind of how you see the video that they're capturing. So again, it has some sort of a web server that's built into these devices, and by default, when you buy the device has some kind of default password, as you well know. A lot of these routers and devices have a default password. I guess a lot of people don't bother changing the password, right? And I think these people figured out that these devices all have this default password. And if you're a webcam that's on the internet, right? Because webcams are really useful if they're on the internet. You know, it doesn't make sense to have a webcam that's only in your house, which means you can only access them in your house. People typically, open up some sort of a router, whatever the wireless router port or something, and allow that particular webcam to be accessed from the internet. So now those webcams are on the internet, and if you haven't changed the password, somehow these guys were probably doing some sort of IP harvesting and things like that, and they figured out which, they got these. Some of the 100,000 devices is what they were able to, compromise. So they got all these IP addresses and they figured out, okay, so all these devices have the default password, so it's easy to get into it. And also these devices also have some bugs in them, because they're basically webcams that probably don't get patched often, or the people who buy them don't patch them. I know mine, I patch it almost like every month. I'm checking for updates, firmware and whatnot, and I'm patching it, but I'm probably in the minority here. They have all these vulnerabilities in them, and some of them allow them to, as I said, because you can actually log into them and you can configure it to do various things. And I suppose one of the things is probably to go and look up to send your picture somewhere, right? We've detected a motion, like they have this motion sensing, and I need to email a picture out to somebody because they detected some kind of motion or something like that, right? These things do work, these webcams. If they're on. And so they figured out some of these vulnerabilities in there, and that's kind of where the whole thing started. They were able to script them, get them in a loop so that they're always doing it over and over again. They're making basically they're making fraudulent requests, right, for non-existent DNS domain names, and they're doing it very often. And eventually these things start cascading up to Dyn to be able to resolve these non-existent domain names. So this is from what little I've read, this is how I understood that why this thing was so easy to do, yet it had the impact that it had and brought down a whole bunch of
That was
servers.
the so when you raised the point, I was trying to figure out how they had gotten into these basically dumb devices, right? Because a lot of times when you see people's computers will be infected in this fashion, right? We talk about botnets and that kind of stuff, but that's usually because somebody has something embedded in a web in a malicious web page, or you click on a link in an email that you shouldn't, and you get code that gets running on your local machine,
Correct.
right? But it kind of there has to be like somebody to start that.
Yes.
A human being has to kind of make a mistake to get that installed. But I hadn't even thought of the fact that all these devices have this default password. I had to reset my router at home maybe a month ago, and I had to go in there and go, "What's the default, username and password for blah?" Because my router ran because I had reset it to factory. Now changed it, so please don't try and get into my modem or into my router. But yeah, no, I mean, I didn't even think about that. But you're absolutely right. I'm sure there's lots of people that never change that stuff.
Right, and then coupled with the fact that not only is default password, but normally the worst that could happen is that somebody can look at you or whatever, your house or something. And that's kind of the worst that can happen. But on top of that, I suppose there are some sort of vulnerabilities or something that are built into these devices if they're unpatched. It allows them to kind of put them in some sort of a loop and do things that eventually cause this Dyn failure. I mean, I guess. Just to tie it to what we were discussing last week with IoT devices, because we touched upon this. It's kind of strange when I read it, when this thing came about. I'm like, oh my God, we just talked about this. So, one of the things we were very clear when we talked about IoT, the IoT hub, is that the IoT devices, we talked about security, and we said that these devices should not have a web server in there for this very reason. Okay, it just these devices should not be addressable from the internet or from anywhere for that matter. Okay, they should be the ones that are going out and connecting to something else. Nobody should connect into them. Okay, so they're clients basically, but they're not servers. And as long as I mean, and kind of. To, I guess case in point is the what you just said about the computers. Same thing. Computers are typically not servers, right? Not all of us are running IIS or whatever on our Windows machines. They're typically just running Internet Explorer, and so you're going out to into the internet, and you might get infected that way. But these IoT devices, we did say that, you know, they should be the ones that are just going out. Nobody should be connecting in for this very reason. And these webcam or these other kind of IoT devices that have the web server built into, they are very, very vulnerable to this kind of hack. Okay, and so that's I just want to make that point that, you know, obviously when we talk about IoT and IoT Hub, and it's also on the Azure website, they do recommend that you do not have a web server running on these, right? Well, as part of the provisioning process for these IoT devices, there's a key that you provide. You configure that in the IoT Hub, and then the IoT device is just talking to the IoT Hub and nothing else, right? It's not talking to some XYZ website or something. It's talking to the IoT Hub. It's a well-known endpoint, and it's got that key, and it's an encrypted connection and whatnot, right? So it's a very secure connection that way, and nobody can connect into it except Azure. So I guess, yeah, you can say, I mean, if somebody hacks into Azure, then I guess we're all going to be in
I'll
trouble.
be very busy
Yeah. We'll all be running around trying to figure out what's going on. Yeah, for you more than anybody else, yes.
But on that same token, you know, these devices, when you say, like, you know, most of the time or a lot of times, people's computers are used to launch these kind of attacks because they can dupe someone into clicking on an email or doing something physically to infect themselves, basically. But if you think about the IoT devices, the thing that kind of you got to remember is, like, those guys are just out there working by themselves. Like, you don't, there's no interface even in sometimes to these things, like we said last week. So you don't even know what's happening there, to be honest. I mean, most people aren't monitoring router traffic at their house to see, like, what's coming in. And so these guys are out there doing work, and you're like, wow, there's an internet down. I wonder if I'm part of that. Like, you know, like.
Oh yeah. You know, I you know, I Sujeet, you know, I see, I told you shouldn't have your webcam at home. Now you help take down the internet. Thanks a lot, man. Yeah, I mean, I get so I th this is one the other part that I didn't hear is how did they get I mean I know I'm sure Dyn had to start, you know, I guess they started blocking IPs and raising their capacity and everything, but you know, unless the whatever the scripts that these devices were doing, you know, were set to time out, this really would never stop. 'Cause you know, to Cale, to your point, like I you know, if I have a webcam that's, you know, if I'm a typical person and I have a webcam that's you know, doing this, like, I wouldn't know. I'd never turn it off. Like, do you guys know how we got out of this?
I don't know how they get out of it, but I've been back in the early 2000s when this stuff used to happen. Like, I worked for a company in Manhattan, and we used to get attacked. Not denial, not distributed denial, but denial of service attacks. And it was just immediate, like you said, Evan. The first thing you do is try to figure out. You could see that stuff starts to coming to a crawl. And you start shunning the ports because basically what's happening is, like, all those packets are hitting whatever the edge is for your network. And eventually somebody's got to go in there and free up those CPUs so that they cannot do it. But the challenge there is, especially in, like, one of these, and that's what makes these so sophisticated, is there's, like, mega proxies on the internet, basically, where it's, like, the opposite of what you think about from a proxy. So, like, all these people are coming from the internet through this one thing eventually. And if you shut that off, you shut off half the East Coast or something, you know, like, so,
Well, and not to mention these, you know, let's say again, this is the, you know, some person's webcam that's on some IP, right? That's presented as an IP from their internet provider. Like, you don't want to just block them entirely because now they can't get anywhere ever, right? So, you know, we actually, you know, we occasionally have customers on the Azure platform that get attacked in the same way, right? Where somebody comes at them with a denial of service. Now the platform protects itself, right? We have things built into the platform to manage these things. But there's that little bit of a gray area in between where it's not big enough to impact the platform, but it is big enough to impact the customer's applications. And really, they're faced with the same choice that we're talking about here is, do I just start blocking traffic? And, well, maybe I have real customers coming from that traffic as well. Like, How do I go about doing it? Now, the nice thing in Azure is they can scale up kind of as a short-term mitigation.
Right.
Bigger machines,
Now,
more resources, but you still have this ongoing challenge of how do you get out of this? And you have to be very careful.
if it's the one thing with these scripts or that they run to hack to create the traffic, is that they're repetitive in nature, right? Scripts are by default repetitive in nature, and so they're probably doing the same thing over and over again. Like, so if they were doing maybe they were querying a non-existent website, they or a domain name, they may have been doing the same one over and over again. So I hopefully at some point, I don't know if that's how they do it, but I'm imagining that they figured out there's this pattern.
Oh, yeah.
And they could have blocked any request to
With
DNS for
that
that
pattern,
particular
yeah.
domain name, for example, right?
Yeah.
Or a bad domain name or whatever it may be, or series of
Yeah.
them. And then that way, and they would do it at source, right? So they would have to work together with these mega proxies or some of the down level, because DNS is a cascading system, right? Dyn is the top level, which is the .com and the .org and .net and whatnot. And then it cascades down to individual DNS all the way to, say, GoDaddy's DNS servers and things like that. And also to Azure DNS servers, which we'll talk in a minute about. But I'm sure they would have worked with all these providers to kind of block that traffic so that it doesn't go upstream into Dyn.
I think the thing for me too was it's one of those things. It's almost like electricity, DNS services, I'll call them.
Yeah,
So
you just
like,
assume,
you
right?
just assume it works, and then when it was like, well, I can't get on GitHub today. Oh, that shouldn't be a problem until like 5 seconds into you start doing something. I need that, but it's on GitHub and I can't get it now. Like,
I heard they were impacted in a big way, right? GitHub, yeah. That's so weird. I just I can never. I mean, just things that you just use on a day-to-day basis. Surprisingly, I mean, I don't know. I mean, without giving away too much, Evan. I mean, did we see a lot of like extra traffic on your side on that day? It was.
As far as customers thinking something was wrong with their side or
Yeah,
their
like on
site.
Azure or something like that.
I was actually not in the office on Fridays. I'm off on Fridays, but
This guy always
I don't
manages to take
recall.
days off on the whenever
Yeah.
something like this happens. You notice this is the second
Hey,
time.
that's called experience here, guys.
Nah, that's the fingerprint of
I did
something. I'm
right.
not sure. Every time Evan's not in the office, we have something bad going on.
To the best of my knowledge, I don't recall. Because I check email and stuff, but. There was nothing. I mean, we didn't really see a whole lot of things. I mean, I think from my perception was, again, kind of outside looking in because I wasn't in the office that day, was pretty quickly everybody knew that it was a broad issue and not kind of individual sites, individual people, right? Maybe kind of early on, people running. But man, when Twitter goes down or when GitHub goes down, that's not, the two of those going down at one, two of the, one of those going down is an event, right? Two of those going down and some of the other ones that went down, that's clearly very quickly, right? You know that's not your stuff. It's not your site. It's something else right at that point. So yeah, I think pretty quickly people realized that and that we didn't really see a significant flood of people on that. So that's good. Good for my colleagues. Again, I was off, so
Yes, the other thing that people have, just mentioned, people have been talking about is, we have Azure DNS, right? Since everybody's talking about DNS these days, and it's like, oh, could this happen to Azure DNS, right? That's kind of I saw that come up a few times, and I mean. Dyn is a top-level DNS server, as we talked about, and I guess the Azure DNS it basically just hosts your own DNS entries, right, for your domain. It doesn't it, it it's not like a repository of thousands and thousands of domains. It's just your domain, right?
So this is it's a relatively new service. We probably ought to at some point dig in and spend some time talking about it. But yeah, that's my understanding as well, is we're really, again, GoDaddy has done this for years as well, right? They host the domains, and then that they make sure that domain gets propagated out, but they're not really the root source of storage where everybody's going to for that request, right? Like Dyn, right? Dyn is everybody at some point. If you try a domain that doesn't exist, you're going to end up at a Dyn or some of their equivalents, right? I don't believe that Azure sits in that chain, right? Azure is inside kind of a source of those records, and it pushes them out to those, you know, top level people, but, and then those get distributed from there, but it's not kind of a repository of those
right.
top
so
level stuff.
So
worldwide.
You're saying it's kind of like GoDaddy's DNS, is that what
yeah,
you're saying?
I mean, that's a pretty, best as I can tell from what little I have had a chance to play with it, it's very similar to in that sense. If you can register your own domain with us, we'll manage it, we'll make sure it gets
right.
propagated out for you, but we're really just focusing on making sure that we kind of have that authoritative record of this name goes to this IP, and we tell everybody else about it. But that doesn't mean you have to come to ask us where that domain or what the IP address is for that domain.
Right, right. Okay, so that's I think that kind of clears it up, because I don't believe we had any problem on Azure DNS for sure.
Not that I saw or heard.
So I think Evan, you kind of mentioned briefly about you know what Azure does to prevent such an event from happening, right? I think we're probably going to. I think next week, right? We have the security guy coming on,
mm-hmm.
and
Azure
we'll probably.
Support Center. Yep.
Yep. So I'm sure this will come up over there as well. But should the Azure customers be kind of worried about this? I guess that's the thing that I was thinking about today.
That's a good question, and I think the way that I would phrase it is, you know, Azure absolutely is aware of this problem, right? We've designed and architected capabilities in the service to do this, to handle this, but like I was saying before, Azure's being attacked all the time. Right. We don't publicize it, you know, and I don't even necessarily track it, but, you know, it would not surprise me in the least if on a very regular basis there's a DDoS against Azure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, being who we are and the different services we host, it wouldn't surprise me in the least. But we have mitigations in place and mechanisms for dealing with that so that just transparently we take care of it. But there is that gray area where, hey, it's the platform's not at any risk. Right, we're not seeing a broad swath of things going down, but it is enough traffic really to take down a site. Right, I worked with a customer a few months back where I think they were getting something on the order of 100,000 requests a day. Right, where for them normal traffic was about 1,000 requests a day.
Okay.
So you know, huge difference for them, and their app just wasn't built or scaled for that. You know, because again, like everything else, you don't always build your app to be super, super scalable. You make design decisions as you go based on time and effort and cost.
Right.
Right. So that is a gray area, and I do, it'll actually be, that'll be a good question for the Azure Security Center folks next week, because I do believe they have some things around detecting that stuff and to help you mitigate and manage those scenarios, because those can be tough scenarios for customers, because there's no button that we can push at the Azure layer that says, hey, I'm getting DDoS, Azure, you know, protect me automatically. Because right. How do we know what's good traffic or bad traffic going to your site?
Yep.
You know, or how can we, you know, it just, there's some ideas we're looking at there, but yeah, there's just not really an easy way to do that.
And I think the one thing here that hits home for me, like two things. One is having to manage this stuff back in the past. I mean, I'm sure that they're much more sophisticated now, but intrusion detection devices and, you know, shunning ports and all these different
yep.
things that you do to block against this stuff, it's not easy. Like, and even if you're a decent-sized enterprise, it's a very specialized, very hard thing to do. Those devices, because, like you said, Evan, the false positive is a big problem.
Absolutely.
Like you blocking legitimate traffic is a big problem, and people will freak out about it, but then, on the same token, you want to make sure you block the bad guy, so it's... There's such a fine line there, and the guys who can do this well really deserve a lot of credit. I mean, because it's hard to do it, even if you spend a lot of money, you know.
Yep. Yeah, there's some very specialized features or specialized products out there, right? That'll do this kind of stuff for you, right? It'll look at the traffic before it passes it on to you.
Yeah.
And then it'll drop it transparently. But man, those are very, like you said, those are very specialized apps that, you know, they cost money and to put into place.
And I know
to do those for fun.
I know that I was going to say, I think Azure and others, they use a lot of heuristics, right? They
yep.
they look at your history of your data patterns, and then if there's something out of the ordinary, they'll either block it or alert somebody to take immediate action.
Well, yeah, that's where the security center stuff comes in, right? That's where we do notify. The security center basically has features and functionality. Say, hey, we kind of see this thing that we think might be there. You're going to want to check it out. Here's some more information on it. But yeah, again, this is really a key distinction because I do pretty regularly run into customers that think we will somehow detect that, hey, that traffic's bad, and we'll just proactively block it. But and again, to Cale's point on false positives, right? That's really to date something we've not done because I can't guarantee that's bad traffic without significant interaction with you as a customer, right, on the platform telling me that is bad traffic.
Yeah, not to you can cut this off if you want to, Sajid, but I'll bring this home to the blockchain world, and this is it totally slipped my mind, but I just want to talk about it just for a sec because I think it's really cool because it's kind of the next gen of DDoS type stuff. So about the time I was in China, when I came back from there, the Ethereum network was under attack. You can imagine these things that have billions of dollars.
Oh, sure, all the time, right? Yeah.
Attack. So this one was specialized too, and it's kind of cool how they fixed it. So they just hard forked again a couple weeks ago. And the hard fork basically means they have to change the core infrastructure, when you hear that word, which basically means the nodes that are running this whole network need to have software updated. And so what happened was when you execute something on the blockchain, there's a gas associated with it. And it's really cool. So basically it'll say, hey, you got this function and it's this complex. So it can calculate how much CPU is going to be required to run that transaction. And then based on that, it's going to say, I need this amount of virtual money to actually execute this thing because this is what it's going to take me to execute it. Now, what's cool is the opcodes at a low level can calculate and say, like, an add function is this much gas, a subtract function is this much gas. Well, guess what? A couple of those opcodes weren't actually scaled right. So I think it was the add function was really low gas. So what did people do? Send a smart contract in there that has really low gas, an add function, run it a million times, and pound the network. So they were spending very little amount of money to basically bring the network to its knees. Because they couldn't, nobody could figure out what was happening. It was like, oh, whoa, they're always hitting this opcode. What's happening? So in that case, we just said, okay, so raise the price of that. Now it becomes infeasible for an attacker to do it because they have to figure out how to pay for that, and it wouldn't work.
Right.
But it's kind of cool to see how DDoS has gone from this network layer, and now you see it in these other areas, but there's different ways to combat it, you know?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I think that's just wanted to table that, you know, and I think we'll continue next week with our security discussion, and looking forward to that. Anything else you guys want to add on this before we close it out?
Yeah, I'm going to go home and check all, make sure I have nothing else that is
exposed. Everybody should change their passwords, and no default passwords.
Just going to roll them just for the sake of rolling everything.
Good idea, Evan. All right, guys. Good discussion, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.